It was her brother Zuga who had found the way back to Africa for both of them. He had returned from India on leave, a man of considerable achievement, already a major in the Indian Army, promotion that he had won in the field, with a reputation of being a soldier and a military administrator of great promise for one so young. Despite this, Zuga was every bit as dissatisfied with his lot as was Robin. Like their father, they were both lone wolves, responding badly to authority and regimentation. In spite of the promising start to his military career, Zuga recognized the fact that he had already made powerful enemies in India, and he had begun to doubt that his future lay on that continent. Like Robin, he was still a searcher, and they had greeted each other after the parting of years with a warmth that they had seldom displayed during their childhood. Zuga took her to dinner at the Golden Boar. It was such a change from Robin's daily surroundings that she accepted a second glass of claret and became gay and sparkling. "My God, Sissy, you really are a pretty thing, you know," he had told her at last. He had taken to swearing now, and though it had shocked her at first, she had grown accustomed to it quickly enough. She had heard a lot worse in the slums where she worked. "You're too good to spend your life amongst those ghastly crones." It changed the mood between them instantly, and she was able at last to lean close to her brother and pour out all her frustrations. He listened sympathetically, reaching across the table to squeeze her hand, so that she went on quietly, but with utter determination. "Zuga, I have to get back to Africa. I'll die if I don't. I just know it. I will shrivel up and die." "Good Lord, Sissy, why Africa?" "Because I was born there, because my destiny is there, and because Papa is there somewhere." "I was born there also," Zuga smiled. And when he did so, it softened the harsh line of his mouth. "But I don't know about my destiny. I wouldn't mind going back for the hunting, of course. But as for Father, don't you often think that Papa's main concern was always Fuller Ballantyne? I cannot imagine that you still harbour any great filial love for him." "He's different from other men, Zuga. You cannot judge him by the usual yardstick."
There are many who might agree with that," Zuga murmured dryly, "at the LMS and at the Foreign Office. But as a father?" "I love him," she said defiantly. "After God, I love him best. He killed Mother, you know." Zuga's mouth hardened into its usual grim line. "He took her out to the Zambezi in fever season, and he killed her as certainly as if he'd put a pistol to her head." Robin conceded after a short, regretful silence. "He was never a father, nor a husband, but as a visionary, a blazer of trails, as a torchbearer." Zuga laughed and squeezed her hand. "Really, Sissy? I've read his books, all his letters, every one he ever wrote to Mother or to us, and I know that my place is there, in Africa, with Papa." Zuga lifted his hand from hers and carefully stroked his thick side whiskers. "You always had a way of making me feel excited." Then, seemingly going off at a tangent, "Did you hear that they have found diamonds on the Orange River?" He lifted his glass and examined the lees in the bottom of it attentively. "We are so very different, you and I, and yet in some ways so very much alike." He poured fresh wine into his glass and went on casually. "I am in debt, Sissy." The word chilled her. Since her childhood, she had been taught a dread of it. "How much?" she asked at last quietly.
£200, he shrugged.
"So much," she breathed. And then, "You haven't been gambling, Zuga." That was one of the other dread words in Robin's vocabulary. "Not gambling," she repeated. "As a matter of fact, I have," Zuga laughed. "And thank God for that. Without it, I'd be 1,000 guineas under."
"You mean you gamble and actually win?"
Her horror faded a little, became tinged with fascination.
"Not always, but most of the time."
She studied him carefully, perhaps for the first time. He was only 26 years old, but he had the presence and aplomb of a man 10 years older. He was already a hard professional soldier, tempered in the skirmishes on the border of Afghanistan, where his regiment had spent 4 years. She knew there had been cruel encounters against fierce hill tribes, and that Zuga had distinguished himself. His rapid promotion was proof of that.
"Then how are you in debt, Zuga?" she asked.
"Most of my brother officers, even my juniors, have private fortunes. I am a major now. I have to keep some style. We hunt, we shoot, mess bills, polo ponies." He shrugged again.
"Will you ever be able to repay it?"
"I could marry a rich wife," he smiled. "Or find diamonds." Zuga sipped his wine, slumped down in his chair, not looking at her, and went on quietly. "I was reading Cornwallis Harris's book the other day. Do you remember the big game we saw when we lived at Konebach?" She shook her head. "No, you wouldn't. You were only a baby. But I do. I remember the herds of springbok and wildebeest on the trek down to the Cape. One night there was a lion. I saw it clearly in the light of the campfire. Harris's book described his hunting expeditions as far as the Limpopo. Nobody has been further than that, except Papa, of course. A damn sight better than potting pheasant or black buck. Did you know that Harris made nearly £5,000 from his book?" Zuga pushed his glass away, straightened up in his seat, and selected a cigar from his silver case. While he prepared and lit it, he was frowning thoughtfully. "You want to go to Africa for spiritual reasons. I probably need to go to Africa for much better reasons, for blood and for money. I make you a proposal. The Ballantine Expedition." He lifted his glass to her. She laughed then, uncertainly, thinking he was joking, but lifted her own glass, which was still almost full. "My word on it. But how, Zuga? How do we get there?" "What was the name of that newspaper fellow?" Zuga demanded.
"Wicks," she said. "Oliver Wicks. But why should he help us?"
"I'll find a good reason why he should." And Robin remembered how, even as a child, he had been an eloquent and persuasive pleader of causes.
"You know, I rather think you might."
They drank then, and when she lowered her glass, she had been as happy as she could ever remember being in all of her life. It was another 6 weeks before she saw Zuga again, striding towards her through the bustle of London Bridge Station as she clambered down from the carriage. He stood tall above the crowd, with the high beaver-top hat on his head and the three-quarter-length cloak flaring from his shoulders. "Sissy!" he called, laughing at her as he lifted her from her feet. "We're going away! We really are going!" He had a cab waiting for them, and the driver whipped up the horses the moment they were aboard. The London Missionary Society were no use at all, he told her, still with his arm around her shoulders as the cab clattered and lurched over the cobbles. "I had them down on my list for 500 iron men, and they nearly had apoplexy. I had the feeling they would rather Papa stayed lost in darkest Africa, and they would pay 500 to keep him there." "You went to the directors?" she demanded. "Played my losing tricks first," Zuga smiled. "The next was Whitehall. Actually managed to see the First Secretary. He was damned civil, took me to lunch at the Travellers, and was truly very sorry that they were not able to give financial assistance. They remembered Papa's Zambezi fiasco too clearly. But he did give me letters, a dozen letters, to every conceivable person, to the governor at the Cape, to Kemp the Admiral at Cape Town, and all the others. Well, letters won't get us very far. Then I went to see your newspaper friend. Extraordinary little man, smart as a whip. I told him we were going to Africa to find Papa, and he jumped up and clapped his hands like a child at a Punch and Judy show." Zuga hugged Robin tighter. "To tell the truth, I used your name shamelessly, and it did the trick. He will have all the story rights to our diaries and journals, and the publishing rights to both books."
"Both books?"
Robin pulled away from him and looked into his face. "Both," he grinned at her. "Yours and mine.
I am to write a book."
"You certainly are. A woman's account of the expedition. I have already signed the contract on your behalf." She laughed then, but breathlessly.
"Oh, you, You're going too far, much too fast.
Little Wicks was in for 500, and the next on the list was the Society for the Extinction of the Slave Trade. They were easy. His Royal Highness is the Society's patron, and he had read Papa's books. We are to report on the state of the trade in the interior of the continent north of the Tropic of Capricorn, and they came up with another 500 guineas.
Oh, Zuga, you're a magician.
Then there was the Worshipful Company of London Merchants trading into Africa. For the last 100 years, they have based all their activities on the West Coast. I convinced them that they needed a survey of the East Coast. I have been appointed the Worshipful Company's agent with instructions to examine the market in palm oil, gum copal, copper and ivory. And they have come up with the third and last 500 guineas and a presentation Sharp's rifle.
1,500 guineas, Robin breathed, and Zuga nodded.
We are going back in style.
When?
I have booked passage on an American trading clipper. We sail from Bristol in 6 weeks, for Good Hope, and then to Mozambique. I have written asking leave from my regiment for 2 years. You will have to do the same with the LMS. It had all happened with dreamlike rapidity after that. The directors of the LMS, perhaps relieved that they were not to pay for her passage, nor the expense of relocating Robin in the African interior, in a flush of extravagance, decided to continue her stipend during the period she was away, and made a guarded promise to review the position at the end of that time. If she proved herself capable, then there would be a permanent post in Africa thereafter. It was more than she had ever expected, and she had thrown herself wholeheartedly into assisting Zuga with the preparations for departure. There was so much to do that 6 weeks was barely sufficient, and it seemed only days had passed before the mountain of the expedition's equipment was being swayed down into the holds of the big, graceful Baltimore clipper. The Huron proved as swift as she looked, another wise choice by Zuga Ballantyne. And under Mungo St. John's skilful navigation, she made good her restings before attempting to cross the belt of the doldrums at their narrowest point. They were becalmed not a single day, and sped across the line at 29 degrees west, and immediately Mungo St. John put her on the port tack to stand down across the southeast trades. Huron clawed her way southwards with the flying fish sailing ahead of her, close on the wind until she broke from their grip at last with Isla de Trinidade on the horizon. The northwester came howling at them, and Huron fled before it, under low, sullen, scudding skies, day after day, that denied them sight of sun or moon or stars, until she almost hurled herself ashore 200 miles up the west coast of Africa from her destination at the Cape of Good Hope. "Mr. Mate," Mungo St. John called in his clear, carrying voice, as Huron settled down to reach across the wind, pulling swiftly away from the land. "Captain!" Tipu bellowed back from the foot of the mainmast, a great blurt of sound from the bull chest. "Take the name of the masthead watch." Tipu ducked his cannonball head on its thick neck, like a bare-knuckle fighter taking a punch, and looked up the mast, slitting his eyes in the heavy folds of flesh. 20 minutes more and he would have had us on the beach." St. John's voice was cold, deadly. "I'll have him on the grating before this day is out, and we will get a peep of his backbone." Tipu licked his thick lips involuntarily, and Robin, standing near him, felt her stomach heave. There had been 3 floggings already on this voyage, and she knew what to expect. Tipu was half Arab, half African, a honey-coloured giant of a man with a shaven head that was covered with a mesh of tiny pale scars from 1,000 violent encounters. He wore a loose embroidered, high-necked tunic over his huge frame, but the forearms that protruded from the wide sleeves were thick as women's thighs. Robin turned quickly to Zuga as he came down the deck towards her.